may love NFL football. I certainly do too. I may love baseball. I love my San Francisco Giants. But I tell you what, everybody sends somebody to the Olympic Games in the 100-meter dash. It is a global event. So he's not running against the best in America. He's not running against, you know, the best in the Midwest. He is running against the planet. I think I wouldn't lose any sleep if Russia were not invited to Rio.
Katie Ledecky has no rivals. Even Michael, during his heyday, never dominated for four straight years in her best events. In the 400, 800, and in the 1500, when it comes to the world championships, nobody's been close. She hasn't lost, man. She hasn't lost in 4 years.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Bette Marston. And this week we have two guests, but this is going to be actually, I think you're really going to like this. It's a show which sort of falls under the banner almost of Olympic preview. And the guests are Otto Bolton, the outstanding NBC track and field analyst. You've seen him on Olympic Games, on U.S. Olympic Trials. Otto Bolton is he's as good as any of the top analysts, regardless of sport. And really looking forward to talking to him about Usain Bolt and the U.S. Olympians who have qualified for Rio in track and field, and Ashton Eaton, and many other subjects in Allyson Felix and track. Should be good conversation. Not to mention, I want to ask him about how he approaches the subjects of drugs on the track, and can that be discussed, and should that be discussed during the Olympic Games. Our second guest is Rowdy Gaines, the fine NBC swimming analyst. Rowdy's done that for many, many years. He's essentially called every big race that Michael Phelps has ever swam. Rowdy himself, of course, gold medalist for the U.S. Olympic team many moons ago. Like Otto, one of the most respected guys in his field, and we will discuss what really is shaping up to be an excellent Olympics, from Ledecky to Phelps to Lochte. But more than that, I want to get into how he approaches his job. How do you research swimming, and how do you call a race? What are the, you know, is there something unique to calling swimming? We'll also ask him about drugs in swimming, and how you address that, or should you address that, during an Olympic meet. So the two guests are Otto Bolton and Rowdy Gaines. They both work for NBC. You'll both see them over the next couple weeks in Rio in very, very significant spots. We're going to start with Otto, who is in Poland. We tracked him down there, and we'll finish up with Rowdy. But I think you're going to enjoy this, particularly if you're an Olympics fan. All right, and as promised, we bring in the outstanding NBC track and field analyst, Otto Bolton, who is in, Otto, you'll have to pronounce the town for me, but you are in Poland right now, am I correct?
I am in Bydgoszcz, Poland, for the World Under 20 Championships in track and field.
Yes. Wow, okay, so doing, is this something that you would normally attend, or is this part of any kind of pre-Olympic preparation?
It's part of my role as the IAAF Global Ambassador, but I also happen to have the number two seed in the girls' 100-meter dash, so I'm doing sort of double duty here.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. I want to talk about your how you approach your job, which you as someone who loves track and field and has covered multiple Olympics, I really appreciate when the people who cover these sports are not only performing at a high level for the people who really know track and field, but also can explain the sport to laymen. And that's where I think you excel at, is that I feel like you educate me, but at the same time, if I'm sort of new to the sport, as I would be as an Olympics watcher, you also help prepare me there. So that's a long intro, and you should pay me for the PR I just gave you. That's a long intro to ask you, how do you prepare to call meets? Because it strikes me that you have many different audiences that you're talking to, especially for the Olympics.
Well, it depends on what meet I'm calling, but specifically for the Olympic Games, one of the things that my producer reminds me all the time, is that you have to broadcast to an audience that has not watched track and field for the last 4 years. We are very well aware at NBC that our Olympic audience is more female than it usually is, and most of them have not watched since the last time. So for me to get on the air and start talking about things which people who are track and field fans would know would alienate them. So how do I prepare? I remember my first games, I totally overprepared because I was so scared of failing. I probably locked myself in the office for about a week, literally. I did not come out for anything other than essential actions. You can make of that what you will. And I prepared for every scenario. I prepared for what I thought Bolt was going to do, who would make the final, how to put it into context. I think I've backed off a little bit since then because that tends to skew me in the direction of giving a lot of stats. And I have to stay away from stats because stats mean absolutely nothing to somebody who's not familiar with the sport. If I'm broadcasting to Ann in the middle of Kansas City and I say, you know, Usain Bolt has run, you know, 5 times under 9.70, that she can't quantify that. If I say that Usain Bolt in the last 8 years has lost one race that counts, I think that's a lot more significant. So I used to prepare by trying to get every stat, and now I prepare by trying to be ready to tell any possible story that would make you care about the person I'm mentioning at the time.
How important is it for you to attend in person the major events such as the Worlds or the U.S. Olympic trials, and what is the difference in terms of your own research when you're on site versus you're at your office watching video highlights or reading about the particular athletes?
Well, we have a fantastic research department at NBC, so I'm always, you know, I usually have a lot of information if I want to use it. But what I do, certainly in the last 3 or 4 years, I look at what's been given to me, and I then look at how I can possibly use it to say something else. Maybe an example of that is, okay, when we were going into the U.S. Olympic trials, you know, we knew that in the hurdle events, 3 of the U.S. best also had the world lead. But none of them actually made the team. So by the time the Olympic trials for the U.S. were done, I was able to use those numbers and say, hey, the U.S., all the people that came into the U.S. trials having the U.S. leaders in terms of performance, not a single one of them in all 4 hurdle events even qualified for the team. So it's for me, it's always trying to take numbers and make them mean more than just numbers.
Otto, you were a great sprinter, world class. Obviously, well, listen, you're an Olympic Games medalist. To me, that is a great sprinter compared to the rest of us on planet Earth. But I ask that as a prelude to: can someone be a good track and field analyst without having competed at the highest level?
I think they can. I think it's almost like asking that question of somebody who is a coach. Like, could you be a great track and field coach without having run the 100? I don't think that you necessarily need one for the other. But I know that one of the things that one of my executive producers said when they hired me is, we want him in the booth because there's nothing that's going to happen in the Olympics that he has not been through. So in that respect, you know, when you think about the stuff that I went through in my own career with all the false start debacle before the 100 and the 1996 Atlanta Olympic 100-meter final, that kind of stuff, they like the fact that I've sort of been through everything and there's nothing that I am not going to either have already experienced or been close enough where I can give an educated opinion on. But no, I think that you can be an analyst without having necessarily been an Olympic finalist or an Olympic medalist. I think you could certainly fill in the gaps with your own knowledge and with your own experiences, even if they weren't at the very highest level.
Otto, NBC recently added Sonya Richards-Ross to the booth with you. There's also obviously a play-by-play person. And this is no disrespect to Sonia, but I want to ask you multiple questions about that. One, do you take any offense at all that NBC felt that they needed to put another person alongside of you? And two, is that too many people in a singular track and field booth?
Well, it's funny because, you know, I've had friends of mine from, particularly from Trinidad, saying, hey, you know, Sonia was pretty good in her debut. Be careful of your job. And the truth is that I have been pushing for us to add a female. And one of the people that I was working with was Lauren Williams, who had done some pen relays for NBC. And I had been sort of coaching her and training her. And NBC knew that. And she did okay. Sonia did not want to start doing her broadcasting at the trials. And I am the one, Sonia and I have been friends for a long time. And I said to her, Sonia, you should start here because the trials are not an easy meet, but I think it's good for you to get reps at a high profile meet like this. You don't want to start at the Olympic Games because that's going to bring its own pressure. So I was the one that encouraged Sonia to start at the trials. And I was the one sort of, I mean, she obviously has, she has talent to broadcast. We've always known that. But I was the one that sort of encouraged them to bring Sonia on board. So I don't feel offended or slighted in the least that they've added her. I thought Sonia complimented our broadcast. The reviews from the public on her were excellent. And to me, I don't dim my light by helping Sonia light hers. Mm-hmm. And I was very happy with how the whole thing worked out. I thought that by the end of those trials that we were in a nice little groove, even though we didn't have Tom Hammond with us, who obviously is going to be in Rio. Sonia's not going to do all the events that I do, but I think they'll bring her along slowly. They're not going to drop Sonia in the booth with me to do the 100-meter final in Rio. And it's because they value the chemistry that Tom and I have and the way we do things. Sonia will get, she'll get her reps and she'll eventually sort of find her role in that booth. But I am thrilled that we finally have a full-time female in the booth because we haven't had one since Carol Lewis in 2009.
Otto, when do you arrive in Rio? How far in advance do you want to be prior to the competition?
I have been on sort of a whirlwind tour because I have athletes who I also coach, and I have three athletes that are going to the games. Natasha Hastings from the U.S., Richard Thompson, and Khalifa St. Ford from Trinidad and Tobago. I have been at everybody's trials. So I went from the Trinidad and Tobago trials to the U.S. trials, and now I'm at the Under 20 World Championships. I go back home in a couple of days after this is done to go cover the United States camp in Houston. And then I get on a plane immediately after that, July 30th, to go down to Rio. Now, people are asking me, well, why are you going down on the 30th and everybody else in track and field is arriving on the 7th? There's a reason for that. They are sort of putting me in a suit and tie for that first week while swimming and gymnastics are going on to tease what's coming. Bolt, Allison, Felix, and all the other big stories, Mo Farah. So, look, you can't ask for more airtime and want to be the ambassador for your sport on your network. And when your bosses say we're bringing you in early so that you can be the track and field guy for us before track and field starts, you can't very well turn that down. So, would I like to go to Rio a little later? Yes, but I understand why they're bringing me in that early.
Otto, what would you say to viewers who would question a broadcaster broadcasting athletes who he has a specific involvement with, as you do?
Yes, that's actually come up. And NBC never had an issue with it because they said that apparently during the Winter Olympics, a lot of their broadcasters actually have choreographed some of the dance, the ice dancing performers. So with me, I think NBC trusts me enough, having been there for 10 years, that, I mean, the first thing is that none of my athletes are that high profile where I think it's going to be a big part of the broadcast. Richard Thompson already had three Olympic silver medals, and he is sort of in his last Olympics. Khalifa St. Ford is only running the relay, and Natasha Hastings is also past 30 and maybe in her in if not her last Olympics, maybe in the last one or two. So I think that they've always been okay with it. And if anything, I think they feel like it makes my broadcasting better, because having had to go back and be a coach, it has sort of returned me to the fundamentals. And I think it makes me a better analyst now that I am coaching. It puts my hands a little deeper into the soil of track and field.
Otto, from the times that I've watched, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but as a general rule, I don't think NBC's track broadcasts, and specifically you, talk a lot about doping within the course of a broadcast. It's obviously a major story in the sport. You can certainly mm-hmm. give me your thoughts on the systematic doping that's come out of Russia. But is that a specific choice for you to avoid, at least in that forum, to talk about doping or doping allegations?
No, I think we have struggled sometimes to find the right tone. I say that this way. I have seen things that we have run where we'll sort of go back into, I think it was Justin Gatlin's past or something like that. And of course our audience goes, you know, they kind of groan. They say, hey, why would you guys, you know, it was 8 years ago. Why would you guys bring that up? And then and on another time, like for the trials, for example, I don't think we mentioned the fact that Justin Gatlin had served a 4-year ban once, and people go, hey, why are you guys giving Justin Gatlin a pass? So it's like, we can never win. If we do it, people say, why would you bring that up? It's over. It's not relevant anymore. And if we don't bring it up, people feel like, oh, well, you know, you guys are the U.S. network. You're giving Justin Gatlin a pass. I think we've really struggled to find the right tone. But to be honest, I've always said, to do my job, I have to believe the performances that are in front of me. So when I step into that booth, when I put on my mic, I can't call a race and think, well, you know, this particular young lady is running a little fast, or she came out of nowhere. Because that's gonna affect how I broadcast. I have to have the passion and be in the moment right then. Now, if 2-3 years from now it comes out that that person has been cutting corners, well, you know, there's nothing I could have done about that. But for me to do my job properly, I cannot have my own personal suspicions sort of creep into my broadcasting. And I think that's the way I'm always going to do it. So that's pretty much been my plan.
That's very interesting. So you really, in the end, Otto, correct me if I'm wrong, though, you can't be a cynic then calling track and field. You almost have to be a romantic or an optimist.
That's exactly what it is. I think that would show up in a very negative way. I think I would hold back maybe in praise or in analysis or in superlatives. And that's not my job. It's really not my job. People are not tuning into me to hear what, you know, because here's the thing. I could speculate and be wrong. That's the other thing. You know, so I think I just have to sort of play it as I see it and let all that other stuff worry about itself. Because if I went in there and really had, it's like, you know, sort of thinking to myself, well, this is, you know, this person's not going to be the Olympic gold medalist, you know, but for another 24 or 48 hours, I think it would affect my broadcasting.
I don't know. Do you have I'm sure you do. The question is what you want to get into it, but what are your thoughts about the possibility of Russia not being involved in the Rio Games, and should they not have, or should they not field the track and field team for this meet?
The more I learn, the more I would be okay if they're not invited. I think with what happened this week and what we learned this week about just how prevalent it was, how systematic it was, I just, you know what, if somebody said, well, you know, we have 10 or 15 Russian athletes who we can conclusively prove the, you know, we're no way involved in what was going on, then I wouldn't have a problem with that. But to be quite honest, like I said, either way, I'm going to do my job, and I'm not going to call a Russian performance any differently than I would an American performance or a Trinidadian performance or a Jamaican performance. So it really doesn't matter to me who shows up in front of me. I still have to cover who's there. But I think maybe as an ex-athlete, I wouldn't lose any sleep if, as an ex-Olympic athlete who lost to dopers in the Olympics, I wouldn't lose any sleep if Russia were not invited to Rio.
I want to ask you one more thing here before we get to Bolt and some of the athletes that we'll see. And that is, in terms of your media sort of digest, Otto, when you, outside of obviously NBC and outside of being at arenas, when you want to read about the sport, can you give the listeners a sense of where do you go? Are there particular websites that you always frequent? Are there newspapers or magazines or particularly writers that you that you sort of consider daily must reads? How does someone who really is an insider in the sport follow the sport on a day to day basis?
I guess I'm going to out myself now because I tend to lurk in websites that maybe you wouldn't think. Let'sRun.com is certainly one of them. Track and Field News Headlines is certainly one of them. When yourself or Tim Layden or somebody whose writing I really like write something, that gets saved because I always feel like I can pull something from there that maybe I can use on the air. But I like to sort of lurk online and see what the public thinks about what's going on, whether it is and sometimes it's any topic. It's, you know, kids going pro, it's drugs, it's Nike, it's, you know, it's, I feel like it, I get very informed by sort of, and of course we know that, you know, online comments can sometimes be a cesspool, but I am a believer that sometimes in, you know, on page 64 of a 100 thread page, you may see something and you go, huh, I didn't think of it that way. And sometimes I think I'm better for having kind of sat in front of the computer and gone through some of the garbage to get to some of the gems.
The people who have appeared on this podcast before, from, you know, well-known play-by-play people to commentators such as Jermell Hill, one of the things that is very sort of is a parallel to all of them is that they really get a lot of social media feedback, particularly negative, especially when you are an opinion maker. You are in a sport that is not the NFL, it is not the NBA, but I do wonder, do you sort of get sometimes the same kind of venom from really crazy track and field people the way so many of my previous guests have gotten it when they offer a, you know, an opinion on LeBron James or an NFL player?
Absolutely. And the difference with me, I think, is that mine is an international sport. So now it becomes a geopolitical event. I'll give you my normal routine. I am half Jamaican, right? I'm also half Trinidadian, but I identify with Trinidad, obviously, because that's where I represented and that's where people know me from. When I have an opinion about a Jamaican athlete, particularly Usain Bolt, and it's my job to have an opinion about Usain Bolt and, you know, whether positive or negative. If I have an opinion that does not line up with the Jamaican fans, then I am a Trinidadian because that's the biggest rivalry in the Caribbean is between Jamaica and Trinidad.
Right.
When that opinion is not one that lines up with the consensus in Jamaica, it becomes a huge issue. And I'll give you an example. Last year, I looked at Justin Gatlin and I went, you know what? The way Bolt looks and the way Gatlin looks, I think Gatlin's actually going to get him this year. Now, of course, we all know that Bolt was able to run down Justin Gatlin and he won by a hundredth of a second. If I could go back to my Twitter feed immediately after that race, it is the stuff of legend. And I looked at some of those people saying, oh, you hate Bolt, you Trinis can't stand Jamaicans, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, where were these people when Michael Johnson in 2008 said, Bolt's not going to get my record. And I went back to my hotel room and figured out the numbers and not only had that Bolt was going to break the record, I had exactly what he was going to run. And I said it on the air. And good thing, everything that I do is on tape because you can always check it. All the things that I had predicted, the world records and all that stuff, all the 99% of the things that I have said that are absolutely glowing about Bolt, all of that gets pushed aside for the hatred for, you know, oh, you thought Bolt was going to lose or whatever it is. I understand that I am the perfect person for this job because to do this job, you have to have very thick skin. And none of that bothers me in the least because I understand that, look, there are certain broadcasters in the United States who they are known to have biases for certain teams, and whether or not it's true, that's how the fans perceive it. And that's why they're called fans. They're fanatics. So when I have, when I have to turn on my TV and some guy is on ESPN or NBC or whatever, and he's, you know, mouthing off about a player that I love, then I hate that person. That's just, that's the game. And as far as I'm concerned, you knew the job was tough when you took it. So I accept that as part of my job. I also accept that the nature of this business is there will be people who think you are the greatest thing for the sport, and there are people who will wonder how you got the job. And I certainly get both sides.
That's fascinating. I did not know that about your geopolitical feed, but now I will follow your mentions, which is fantastic. How should, you know, obviously Usain Bolt will be the biggest star of the track and field competition, arguably the biggest star of the games, you know, whether, however you see Michael Phelps or you don't, but how should we look at Bolt right now, Otto, in terms of among, not just track, among the greatest athletes of all time, and should he double, or should he even go gold in the 100 or gold in the 200? How should we look at him after the fact? Because it strikes me that if he doubles again, you can make the argument he's the greatest athlete of all time, independent of sport. If he medals again, he's, you know, he's in your top 10, top five. I, but I wonder, as someone who is in the sport, how do you see him now, and how do you potentially see him if he shows us magic again in Rio?
I feel like I'm enough of a fan of every sport that I can, even though I am a sprinter and a Caribbean man and a track and field broadcaster, my comments, if Bolt is able to pull off this triple for the third Olympics in a row, will be something along the lines of, you know what, for your consideration, ladies and gentlemen, Bolt on that list that includes Gretzky, Pelé, Ali, whoever you have as Jordan, whoever you have as the very, very best in sport that have transcended their sport and become something more, and they're in the pantheon of just great, greatest athletes ever. Bolt, you have to put him in there. You have to put him in there. And I know that there's a big cross section of the American audience that looks at Bolt and they go, yeah, well, he's tall and he can run fast, but you know, sprinting is not really a sport. You know, you got to get hit or put on pads or swing at a baseball or whatever. But I think people who really know track and field and know the history of it and realize that, look, what this guy has done, nobody has done. And you may love NFL football. I certainly do too. I may love baseball. I love my San Francisco Giants. But I tell you what, everybody sends somebody to the Olympic Games in the 100-meter dash. It is a global event. So he's not running against the best in America. He's not running against, you know, the best in the Midwest. He is running against the planet. And over the past three Olympics, if he's able to pull that off, he will have literally gone up against the planet. And he will have been found to have beaten everybody on the planet convincingly for three consecutive Olympics. And I like Michael Phelps too, but I feel like what Bolt could potentially do in Rio should elevate him to that sort of status.
Are the Jamaicans favored in the 4x100, Manato, giving Bolt a chance at a third gold?
Yes, they are, because even though the Jamaican team, the Jamaican guys behind Bolt are not running quite as fast, Jamaica's last mistake in a big race, well, I should say their last fatal mistake in a big race was probably 2007. They have literally gone every single Olympics and World Championships. Even if they've made small mistakes, they've recovered from them. So in the meantime, the U.S. tends to have really bad problems getting the stick around. They had that problem last year as well in the World Championships when they passed out of the zone. So yes, Jamaica is the favorite in just about every 4x1, not just because they have faster personnel, because I don't know if the average times this year actually have that much of a difference between them. But the truth is that Jamaica is the favorite on the men's side because they have passed the baton so well.
There obviously will be a lot of attention on David Rudisha and Mo Farah, who, if anybody remembers, the London Olympics was incredible and returns again. Are there particular American athletes who, I'm sorry, are there particular athletes competing in track outside of some of the people who have become household names beyond track, like Rudisha and Usain Bolt and Gatlin, that you are particularly thinking could really be a breakout in Rio, the way we saw Allyson Felix a couple of years ago as a breakout in her games, and, you know, Rudisha obviously last year. I was there in London watching that live. It was one of the greatest things I've ever seen. So are there a couple athletes you think by the end of the Rio games that who are not household names today but will be after potentially doing something great on a global level?
Well, becoming a household name in track and field in the United States is always a tough task.
Right.
I think if Allyson Felix, I think if Allyson Felix pulls off that 400 meters and gets gold somehow in the 4x1 and the 4x4 like she did in London, to go home from two consecutive Olympic Games with three gold medals in each, I think you hear a lot of FloJo talk, and I think she will sort of get the well-deserved hype as to, you know, just how great it's been to be able to watch Allyson Felix's career. I think if Justin Gatlin pulls off the upset on Bolt somehow, that he also is going to go down, that's going to elevate his status a lot, especially back home, where I think people have been a lot more forgiving of sort of his past transgressions. I think the person who could really break out might be somebody like a Brittany Reese, because Brittany Reese is just jumping incredibly. She just broke Jackie Joyner Kersee's long jump Olympic trials mark, which has been there forever. And even though the long jump is not a sort of a marquee event in terms of how we cover it, I think it could be. I think that if Sydney McLaughlin, who will be 17 in Rio, I just feel like she has the combination of looks and personality and performance where she doesn't need to win. And let's face it, it would be a long shot for her to win. If that 17-year-old high school young girl gets a medal, I think America will fall in love with her. I really do. And I feel like she could almost get right into that space that Allyson Felix has been in, where people go, I just love her. I saw her. I listened to her. And I love her. And she's 17. And I'm going to follow her for a long time. So I think it could be the potential for those athletes that I mentioned to really sort of ascend to a level that they are not maybe right now.
You give Tori Bowie a shot at that as well, especially in the 200?
Tori Bowie has a shot, but what Tori Bowie has too is she has some really, really tough opposition. Right now, I can't pick Tori Bowie to win either one, because I think right now Elaine Thompson of Jamaica is the favorite in the 100, and I think she has a lot more to give. And I think right now, I probably make either Elaine Thompson or the Netherlands' Daphne Schippers as the favorite in the 200. So if Tori pulls it off, yes, the possibility is there. I just feel like there's two chances against really, really good competition where, you know, I mean, if Tori leaves Rio with two silvers, that's a great meet for her. But I don't think two silvers will get her in that conversation as one of the stars of the game. Sean Merritt has a chance to be really, really, you know, have a big, big meet too, because we don't know. I mean, if Bolt's hamstring didn't hold up for all of the Jamaican trials, who's to say it's going to hold up for all of the Olympic Games? So right. You have the possibility of LaShawn winning the 400 and getting back the title that he last won in 2008. And then now he looks up and, you know, maybe Bolt's done that 200. And Gatlin is not a young guy anymore, and maybe he's fatigued from the 100. And maybe LaShawn Merritt is the one who goes home with the 400-200 double, which nobody would have seen coming because it wasn't sort of hyped and advertised like, you know, a Michael Johnson or Allyson Felix.
That's interesting. Although, man, Justin Gatlin looked good in the 200 at the trial. That was a stunning run.
Yes, it was.
All right, final two for me. I know this is sort of, there's field involved in this, but, you know, there was once a time, Otto, and you're old enough to remember this, that the decathlon winner was among the most famous athletes in the United States. Ashton Eaton is an incredible decathlete, has a chance to go gold. In fact, he's absolutely the overwhelming favorite, yet he is no close to, he's just not a household name. Great-looking guy, great story with his wife, who's an Olympian as well, yet it tells you a lot about where the decathlon is in this country, that a guy like that Still, I think if you walk down the streets of New York, honestly, 99 out of 100 people would not know who he is.
I agree. And he's probably the athlete from the United States that is getting the most. I mean, he's in every commercial. So I see him on TV all the time. But like you said, I don't think that America looks at that and go, oh, you know, they say, oh, that's Ashton Eaton. I think it actually has to do with cultural attention span. So back when it was then Bruce Jenner, who was the 76 Olympic decathlon champion, I think the public sort of had the attention span to sort of follow the decathlon and these 10 events and so on. I just feel like now, if you don't, you know, if you don't package it and if you don't get it ready so that it's sort of more consumable quickly, I don't feel like people have the attention for the decathlon. I know that's also I know that's probably also because track and field is not isn't held in the same sort of regard that it was 40 years ago. But yeah, it's a real shame because Ashton Eaton is one of the greatest athletes on the planet, if not the greatest. He has a great personality. He's a good-looking guy. He's another guy that we think the day he's done running, he can step into a broadcast booth. And yet, yeah, track it, you know, the American public does not, I mean, outside of obviously Eugene, Oregon, the American public does not just, you know, sort of revere that man the way they should. And he keeps setting world records. So it's not like, you know, it's not like he sat on his laurels, literally.
Final one for me, Otto. This is from our mutual friend Tim Layden, who wanted me to ask you this because he knows how much you love Bolt and love talking about Bolt. What is track and field going to be like after Usain Bolt walks away?
That is not an easy void to fill, and for me, I am maybe a little selfish about it because I have sort of been able to hitch on to the Bolt wagon. I don't know that my career would be what it is without being able to call the, I don't know, 6 or 7 world records that he has set that I've been able to call. So for me, I am selfishly hoping that he decides, you know what? Nobody really got close in 2016. Let me stick around till 2020. I doubt that's going to happen. But to answer your question specifically, track and field will have to replace Bolt with really good head-to-head matchups. So back in my era, which preceded Bolts and maybe Asafa Powell, you didn't necessarily have some one person who was really, really dominant in the sprints. But because every meet was Maurice Greene and Dennis Mitchell and myself and Donovan Bailey and Bruni Surin and Frankie Fredericks and Michael Johnson, whoever else, the public couldn't help but be interested because it was like having a heavyweight fight every week. In the Bolt era, they've gone away from that, in part because Bolt has sort of sucked all the money out of all these some of these races. I just feel like we have to get back. It means that the Diamond League, which I think is really struggling right now, we have to, as a sport, get back to giving the fans matchups. People want to see world records, but they also want to see really, really good matchups. So I feel like the powers that be have to plan for that and realize that if you're going to fill the void left by a megastar like that, you have to really, really bring it in terms of competitive races.
That's really interesting, Otto. I appreciate that answer. All right, the guest has been Otto Bolton. He is the lead analyst for NBC Sports' track and field coverage. You'll see him in Rio with Tom Hammond and Sonia Richards-Ross. You hear Otto when it comes to the major track and field events in this country. He really is outstanding. If you have not heard him, and I'm not just saying this because he's on the air with us, but he is, as honestly, and I've written this, he really is as good as the top guys in their respective fields, whether you think somebody like Chris Collinsworth is at the top of his level or John Smoltz in baseball. That is Otto Bolden for track and field people, and as someone who loves the sport, I really appreciate it. Otto, listen, we've corresponded on Twitter, and I've talked to you in the past. I really appreciate you coming on today. And I enjoy your work very, very much, as does my producer, Bette Marston. So, safe travels to Rio, and we'll be watching you on NBC. Thanks so much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks for having me on, and thanks for all the kudos. I appreciate it.
The world's best athletes, as you know, are converging on Rio for the Summer Olympics, and SI has a special podcast channel. Love this. Special podcast channel that will bring you all the top stories in podcast form as they happen. Just go to your podcast app of choice and search for Sports Illustrated at the Games. That's Sports Illustrated at the Games. You can also visit SI.com/Olympics for SI's complete coverage of the Games, produced by our own Bette Marston and Ben Eagle. All right, and as promised, we bring in the NBC Olympic swimming analyst, Rowdy Gaines. He will be with Dan Hicks and Michelle Tafoya in Rio, calling both the men's and women's swimming meets. Rowdy has been NBC's Olympic swimming analyst, the lead analyst, since the 1992 Barcelona Games, and he joins us from Orlando. Rowdy, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thank you, Richard. Good to be with you, buddy.
All righty. I want to start off with, and you're going to be part of a podcast with Otto Baldwin, and you're both interesting to me because you are very good at what you do, but what you do in broadcasting is very niche. When it's not niche is the Olympic Games, when you may get 20, 30 million people watching or listening to what you have to say. So my first question for you is, when you are broadcasting the Olympics, are you a different broadcaster than you might be broadcasting an Olympic trials or a smaller swimming meet?
That's a great question, Richard. And the short answer is yes. I mean, I know that it's a broader audience, and I know that sometimes I have to break down what the flags mean in the swimming pool, which I would never have to do on a regular swimming broadcast, even at the Olympic trials, which is sort of niche because most of that audience is going to be real fans of swimming instead of fans of the Olympics. Also, on the flip side of that, I don't get as technical with stroke technique at the Olympic Games. You know, I won't break down the stroke like I would at normal meets. So it goes both sides of the fence when it comes to doing the broadcast of the Olympic Games, because it's a completely different animal, because I'm literally broadcasting to my mom, you know, or a mom who doesn't know anything about swimming and cares much more about the athlete and cares much more about the story of the athlete than how fast he was at the, you know, at the 50.
Right. As I mentioned at the top, you've been calling the Olympics for NBC since 1992. Which means you have called every Michael Phelps Olympic race. And I wonder how much of Phelps' success has helped your broadcast success, because you have been one of the voices for someone who has transcended the Olympics and is probably thought of in whatever the sort of Mount Rushmore arguments about the greatest athletes of all time, independent of sport, in this country.
Yeah, I mean, Richard, it's pretty amazing to think that I really have been honored, and in many ways a blessing to be able to call almost every single one of Michael's races, even outside the Olympic Games. And the reason why I say that is he has changed our sport more dramatically than any other person or entity in history. I mean, he's Michael Phelps. He won 22 medals, 18 of them gold. So for me, you know, the trials and tribulations he's had outside the pool and what he's done in the pool really in the long run will really help the sport. And our sport has had tremendous growth because of Michael. Before 2000, Richard, I probably called three, maybe four swim races on television per year. By the middle of 2000s, like 2005, 2006, after the Athens Games, I was calling 20 a year. And now I'm up to like 30, 35 broadcasts a year. Now, a lot of that has got to do with more TV channels and et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of that has to do with Michael Phelps and the way he's changed our sport.
Rowdy, let's say Michael Phelps wins some more medals in Rio, whether it's the 100 butterfly or the 200 butterfly. Very, very, very big possibility. Certainly in the 100, I would think he's favored. Relays, he may win some medals. His place in the Olympic history is already secure given the numbers. But let's presume that this is his last Olympics. He wins a couple medals here. Where do you rate him among American sports people? I'm not asking you about swimming because I think he's at the top. Right. So where would you, if you were thinking about the Jordans and the Alis and the Gretzkys, et cetera, Where do you, and admittedly you're biased, you're a swimming person, but where would you, where do you see Michael Phelps? Where do you see Michael Phelps within that story?
That's the first thing I want to say is I'm certainly biased. That's a wrong question to ask a guy that's been around swimming for 40 years.
No, it's the exact right question, right?
As unbiased as I can, I certainly think, and it goes back to what you just said at the very beginning. I definitely think he belongs on Mount Rushmore. He's certainly one of the five greatest athletes in history. If I'm choosing, I think he's the greatest. Now, a lot of people will sit there in a bar and tell me, well, swimming's not really a sport. You know, Charles Barkley, not to digress, but I'll digress a little bit. Charles was on the NBA podcast. This was a couple years ago, and they asked him who the greatest athletes in Auburn history were. And he goes, well, you know, I'm first, and Bo Jackson second, and Frank Thomas is third. And he said, I put Rowdy Gaines fourth, but swimming's not really a sport, you know. So, but I do believe it's a sport. And the reason why I say Michael's on Mount Rushmore, and I think he's at the top, is the fact he has been on top for so many years. What athlete that can you name that has been at or near the top for 16 years? I mean, you take away the year or so that he was retired after 2012. He's literally been at or near the top of his profession for that long. The longevity alone is incredible. Now, there are certain athletes I'm sure you could probably come up with, but I can't think of one. I tweeted that out the other day, and somebody mentioned Floyd Mayweather, and I don't know how long he's been around, but certainly that may be the case. But because of Michael's longevity, because of his dominance, and because of single events that happened, that 8 gold medals, that perfect storm in 2008, there's so many superlatives that you can start naming that he was so dominant in that I would definitely put him on Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, you know, Cam Newton's success, Rowdy, has dropped you down that Auburn great list, so I apologize for that.
But I'm down to fifth, and I guarantee you Charles would say that, too.
In terms of specific preparation for calling the Olympics, and you can go as long as you want, how do you prepare to broadcast whatever it is, a 6 or 7 day meet?
Well, it's 8 days
long.
We'll be at the pool literally, Richard, I'm guessing between 16 and 18 hours a day. We live at the pool. Now, you know, my dad says, hey, it beats digging ditches, quit complaining. And I'm not complaining, but it's a lot of work. I mean, it's a lot of studying, it's a lot of research. A lot of the research that we do we'll never use, but we always need to be prepared. We do a lot of rehearsals. Our producer, Tommy Roy, Dan Hicks, Michelle Tafoya, our director, Joe Martin, they're all just incredible. I mean, I say this with all sincerity. I'm so humbled just being around these people because they're so, so good at what they do that I feel like, you know, I feel like I need to have this tremendous commitment just to stay up with them. Nobody prepares better than Dan that I've ever worked with. And he not only is great at preparation, but he also is such a great mentor to me. He helps me so much. First of all, he's very patient because I screw up a lot, dude. And so he's very patient with my screw ups, and he's a great friend, and those kinds of things really help our broadcast, I think, because I like everybody that I work with at the Olympic Games, and including our leader, our fearless leader, Tommy Roy.
Rowdy, one of the things, correct me if I'm wrong here, you, in addition to the role of NBC analyst, You have a formal role with U.S. Swimming. Am I correct in that, or some kind of role?
Yeah. I still am an ambassador to the USA Swimming Foundation, which is the kind of the philanthropic arm of USA Swimming.
Okay. This leads me to a question where I know that as part of the Olympic team, as part of the NBC Olympic team, you will be part of viewing the U.S. Olympic team training. Prior to the games, you guys get some really significant access in terms of practice. You eat meals with them. You get to know them a little bit outside the sport. So with that, and in particular, given the relationship that you have with U.S. Swimming, I do want to ask you directly, how do you balance between providing objectivity for viewers when you do have a mm-hmm. role that is connected to the swimming body?
Well, it's hard. I mean, to be quite honest with you, it's not easy, Richard. I mean, I was born and raised in the United States. I swam on the U.S. Olympic team. And in a way, I'm an ambassador to the sport in our country, USA Swimming. But I've been doing it long enough, buddy, that I feel like I have the chops to be able to be completely neutral. First and foremost, I'm a fan of fast swimming. I don't care who goes fast. I love to watch swimmers swim. And if somebody from, you know, Lithuania, like Rūta Meilutytė, wins the 100 breaststroke in Rio and breaks a world record, I feel genuine excitement over that race, because I also get to know a lot of the international kids. And I don't think there's a nicer guy on the planet than somebody like Mitch Larkin, who's a backstroker for Australia, that it's easy to root for because he's such a good guy. So I get to know these other athletes from around the world. And I feel like I'm completely impartial. But I get criticism that I'm, you know, this pro-American and things like that. But I've gotten criticism. The way I look at it, buddy, is I also do the college format. I do the NCAAs. I do a lot of the conference meets. Well, I went to school at Auburn, right? And I get half the people say that I am way too much of a Auburn homer. And then the other half, which is the Auburn fans, say I never mention Auburn enough. So I know I'm doing my job right. And it's the same way with covering the Olympic Games. Half of the critics tell me I'm being way too much pro-USA, and the other half say I'm not talking about USA enough. So that's when I know I'm doing my job.
Rowdy, having talked to many NBC executives over the years, one of the things that I know that takes place when the talent is part of production meetings is NBC producers really do tell you to be very careful about coming off too pro USA. In other countries,
absolutely.
In other countries, we certainly see that. So, as someone who's at the who's calling the event, and you're getting caught up, obviously, in the excitement. You know, that's the reason why you want to call this stuff, is because it's exciting. It's great to see. We're all sort of deep down, I think, rooting for our country. So what? Twofold question. One, what are the producers specifically telling you, and do you have to either consciously or subconsciously, when you're on the air and you see somebody like Phelps or Missy Franklin about to break records, what happens in your brain? Are you sort of trying to temper your own patriotic enthusiasm on air?
The first answer to your question about NBC is the bottom line for them is we are never supposed to say we or us. It's always about USA. The USA does this. USA has a relay. USA has a chance to win gold, something like that. We're never supposed to say we. And I can't think of another country's broadcast, as far as what I've seen over my years of traveling and seeing Olympic broadcasting, that does that. I mean, Great Britain was, oh my gosh, it was ridiculous how much they said.
Which is fine.
I mean, that's the way it is. I don't have a problem with that, but that's not the way that we do things here in this country, or the way we do things for NBC. And I understand that as well. I'm supposed to be as neutral as possible. But getting back to the second part of that question is the fact that I am broadcasting to an American audience. I'm not broadcasting to an audience from France. I'm broadcasting to Americans. So if I show a little bit more excitement inside over an American winning a race, you know, I can't help it. That's just the way I am, you know. I mean, I get excited for an American to win a race. But again, going back to what I said earlier, I get excited about an Australian winning a race if it's done the right way, just as much. You'll see my voice not change inflection whatsoever when somebody from Australia wins as much as an American wins. Now, deep down inside, do I think, oh, that's great that Nathan Adrian won the 100 freestyle in London by 1/100th of a second over an Australian? Yeah, I can't help it, dude. I won the 100 free in the Olympics. It's nice to see the 100 free stay in America. It's the first time since Matt Biondi won. the Hunter Freeze. So, yeah, I do get a little bit more excited about that. I can't help it.
Yeah, as someone who covered the London games and watched the BBC, they were, especially in track and field, my God, that you might as well paint the Union Jack on their faces.
For diehard football fans, it's time to gas up and hit the road. Who wrote this copy? Because as of this week, NFL training camps have officially begun. As he does every year, Peter King is heading out in the Monday morning quarterback van to visit with NFL teams as they prepare for another season. Check out the MMQB podcast on your favorite app or hear the whole network at si.com/podcasts. All right, Rowdy, one more question about sort of the specific race calling coverage. And that is, and this is obviously going to be a story in Rio, certainly on the, in the track and field competition. But how do you approach the role of talking about performance-enhancing drugs during a broadcast? It strikes me that we don't often hear that on a swimming broadcast, not as much even on a track broadcast. So how do you – but it's a factor in sports. So how do you – how do you measure having a discussion, if at all, on air about PEDs?
Well, I have to be me, Richard. If it's brought up to me in a question format, either from Dan or if I'm in studio with Bob Costas or something like that, I'm going to say how I feel. NBC has never, ever tried to muzzle me in explaining how I feel about swimming, about drugs and sports, about anything else. And they've been very open about the fact you need to be you. And I've always appreciated that. So I've been outspoken about this subject, on the whole social media thing and on my interviews. I think it's the one and only thing that can destroy the Olympic movement. I mean, we're on the edge of a cliff right now. And if something's not done, then we're going to be in deep, deep trouble in the Olympic movement. And that should really worry the IOC and the people in power of the Olympic movement, because people care about Olympians a lot more than they do a baseball player or a football player getting caught for steroids. They hold us in a higher standard. I'm not saying that we're better than a football player or baseball player, but the Olympics has a different meaning to the public, and they will tune us out if we don't do something about it. And so if it gets asked of me, I'm going to talk about it. But really my role, I don't have enough time to talk about it, Richard, during a broadcast. I'm literally talking about what's happening in front of me. And I have, the 100 fly and the men's 100 fly, I have 51 seconds to talk. I don't have enough time to talk about drugs and sport when there's a 51 second race in front of me. So unless it's a format like this where it's actually asked of me, I'm not going to end up talking about it because this won't be time.
Rowdy, if you could put a percentage on it, at least in swimming, what is the percentage you think of clean racers and who will be swimming in the Rio Olympics?
That's a good question. Percentage. I never broken it down. Well, the pessimistic optimist in me would like to think 90%. I think 90% of the swimmers that will be in Rio will be clean. Unfortunately, that 10% could be really, really good. And it could be more. I would stake my reputation that I think our country, the United States, and I think Australia, I think some of the main countries that will be the biggest factors in swimming are clean. Do I know that for sure, Richard? I have no idea. But I think I have a pretty good pulse on the sport, and I have pretty good contacts in the sport that would know, that would tell me. And I've never seen it in the U.S., and I've never seen it in Australia. I've never seen it in France. So I believe that for the most part, most of the athletes that will be vying for gold will be clean. But there will be some good ones that I will have my suspicions on. And, I'm not going to say that on TV because it's their only suspicion. So it wouldn't be fair to that athlete and it wouldn't be fair to that country, and it certainly wouldn't be fair to my employer, NBC.
I want to ask you a couple questions about some swimmers that we're going to see. And the great thing about the Olympics, of course, is that over the course of a 17-day period, an athlete can go from sort of semi or even essentially not known into a household name. Katie Ledecky, obviously, is somebody who is known in the swimming world, but mm-hmm. she has not broken out in terms of sort of your popular American culture. It strikes me mm-hmm. that she has a real shot to do that. For those of us who only sort of see her tangentially or just have seen her in the trials, can you sort of give us a sense of just sort of historically how potentially good she may be, given that she has a real chance to win 3 gold medals, 4 gold medals? It's to me, she just strikes me as somebody who, like Missy Franklin, can really be the star yeah. of these games.
Yeah. Richard, I like I said, I've been around the sport now for about 40 years, I guess, and been to every single game since 1984. So this is my 9th straight Olympics. I've never seen a more dominant swimmer in my lifetime. Now, you're saying, well, what about Michael Phelps? Certainly Michael Phelps in a single Olympic Games, maybe in a 2-year span, certainly was that dominant. But he always had a rival. Michael always had a Michael Cavitch, you know. Michael always had a Ryan Lochte. Katie Ledecky has no rivals. Over the last 4 years, which is also the secondary part of that, is the fact that because of this span of 4 years, even Michael during his heyday never dominated for 4 straight years in her best events. In the 400, 800, and in the 1500, when it comes to the world championships, nobody's been close. She hasn't lost, man. She hasn't lost in 4 years on the international level at the big meets, you know, world championships, Pan Pacs, Olympics. She hasn't lost. So for me, that's pretty amazing. And she's got a chance to certainly be sort of like Missy was 4 years ago. You know, I think she's got a great shot of winning 4 gold medals. There's one event that she does have rivals in, and that's the 200 freestyle. But the other ones, the 400, 800, and to some degree, the 800 freestyle relay for the United States, they're really, they really are going to be huge favorites. And she could win the 800 freestyle by 15 seconds, which is just, it's just mind-boggling.
Wow. I want to ask you about, within the context of who American sport Olympic viewers should be looking at beyond the Americans, and our Olympic preview issue came out, and one of the things we do in this issue, which is actually always a pretty cool thing, is we pick every medal.
Yeah, it is.
And
absolutely. I haven't gotten my issue yet. When's
it coming,
come out?
Rod? It's being routed to you as we speak. I'll get on the circulation department.
Okay, I get it on Thursday.
You get it on Thursday, exactly. Right. And you're one of the few people who can say when you get it. I think you were on the cover of that magazine once. Am I correct about that?
No. It wasn't me. It was actually Jeff Float, I think, in 84 made the cover.
Oh, wow.
That
you didn't
first
make it in
84? I know usually we have a swimmer that has a cover on the right. first week, but I wasn't on the cover.
I'm
no,
surprised.
No, I wish, but
yeah.
I wasn't.
I know Biondi was. I know Phelps, obviously.
Biondi was. Yep, Nelson Diebel in 92.
That's right, right.
There's been a few swimmers, no doubt.
Oh, well, Rowdy, on behalf of the editors in 1984, I want to apologize. We're sorry that we did not put you on the cover.
I didn't deserve it, buddy. I didn't deserve
it. I might have been in grammar school, but I'll take the hit for that. Someone who we are picking to do very, very well, I have not seen her swim, but I am curious to get your take on her and obviously her country, is Emily Seebohm, am I pronouncing that right, of Australia,
yep.
the backstroker.
Yep.
So she,
yep.
we're picking her to win both the 100 meter and the 200 meter. And this is a long-winded question about where does the Australian swimming program stand in being a significant rival threat during these Rio games to the U.S.?
Well, they are as much of a significant threat this year as they have been since 1956. You got to remember, USA Swimming has been number one in the world since 1956. Think about that. They've won more medals. They've won more, based on the point system and medals of any international meet held that year, than any other country for 60 straight years. That's It's a long time for one country or a team or anything to be that dominant in one sport. But 56 was the last time they lost the medal count. Well, it was to Australia. And this year, the Australian team, on paper anyway, is the strongest since that 56 games. Do I think that they're going to beat the U.S. in the total medal count? No, I don't. But they are going to be very good. I mean, on paper, I mean, you know, you have your SI. I mean, you guys probably guessed it. But my guess is, you know, the U.S. is probably in the mid-20s on medals, and Australia may hit 20. So they're going to be close, no doubt about it. They're going to be much closer. But Emily Seebohm's a real deal. In fact, they have the backstroke king and queen now with Mitch Larkin and Emily Seebohm.
That's right.
You know, with the Campbell sisters and this guy Cameron McAvoy on the sprints for the Australians, they're going to be really, really good.
Roddy, one last topic that I want to get in with you, and that's access at the games to athletes in terms of NBC swimming coverage. And we'll see Michelle Tafoya, obviously, on the deck talking to a lot of these athletes. But traditionally, over the course of your time covering Michael Phelps, how accessible has he been during the games to NBC, given that so much was at stake and that he obviously would be the person that, at least in swimming, that Americans most wanted to hear from? What has been your experience in terms of not only Phelps on air with you guys, but just maybe even off air talking to you, giving you and Dan Hicks, et cetera, a sense of what each race is like for him, or what the experience has been like for him at those Olympics?
Well, first of all, Michael has never been anything but nice to me. Anything I've ever asked for him, he's always provided. You know, if I 10 years ago, if I texted him and said, I need an autograph sent to this person, he would do it in a heartbeat. But I never really knew Michael, Richard. I mean, covering him, I talked to him, but it's always been very professional as far as the relationship. I think over the last year or so, I've gotten to know Michael better, and I know him more now in a year than I did in the first 15 years covering him. He has really changed. He certainly has put this whole sport of swimming in perspective, and you know, a lot of that are the trials and tribulations that I mentioned that he went through. A lot of them put on by himself, and a lot of it's just, you know, having a child and realizing his place in history is secure no matter what he does in Rio. If he goes in Rio and bombs, nobody's going to remember that, and nobody's going to remember he bombed in Rio. Do people remember Muhammad Ali getting beat up? Do people remember Michael Jordan playing on the Washington Wizards? No, they remember the glory days, and Michael's place is secure in history. But he really has been a joy to kind of get to know over the last year or so. We couldn't get rid of him in the booth with Dan and I the first two nights at the trials. He didn't swim till the third day. He kind of hung out with us the whole time during trial. He's never done that. And Michael's really good from a broadcasting role. So if he wanted to have this career as an analyst in the future, he will certainly have me fired. That's for sure.
Well, I was basically going to say is, could you maybe just sort of whisper in Michael's ear, listen, there's a lot of opportunities for you beyond broadcasting. Let's not be crazy and go into this.
Yeah, I know. I tried to tell him, hey, dude, you're going to have to be at the pool 18 hours a day. You're going to be sleeping on, you know, cots in the edit room. You don't want to do this. You don't want to do this, do you? But he would be good. He's really good at and he's gotten so much better. I mean, Richard, compared to the first time we interviewed him when he was, you know, a young 15-year-old in 2000, it, you know, obviously it's night and day. You know, that's obvious for major reasons because of age. But his maturity level has certainly grown, and his analysis of the swimming and just being in the booth with Dan and I, and even without Dan and I, he comes up in the booth with us during these little smaller meets that are on NBC Sports and stuff. So he's been a joy to get to know, and he really is a good guy.
Last one for me, Roddy. Do you get an opportunity away from the pool to see other events? And if so, is there a particular event that you really want to make sure that you see in Rio, whether it's both running the 100 or the 200 or something else?
Well, let me first say about swimming. People ask me all the time, Rich, what's the number one event you could pick on the men and women's side that you're most looking forward to? And for me, it's the women's 200 free, because we talked about that. We've got Missy and Katie that race from the United States. And then that's the one that's the diciest for Katie to win, because there's five or six women that can win that. And then on the men's side, for me, it's the 100 fly. Most people would think the 200 IM, and that's probably second on the list because of Lochte and Phelps. But the 100 fly, I mean, Phelps has won that race in three successive Olympics by 28 one-hundredths of a second. So for some reason or another, he has that magical touch. And that's definitely the one. But I'm going to try to get to other events after swimming is over with. Before, there's no way. Man, I'm from August 6th to August 13th, I'm living at the pool. So I don't see any other events. In fact, I don't even know what's going on in the Olympic Games during those first 8 days, except what's happening in the pool. But when I'm done, I love beach volleyball. My wife loves that. She's going down with me, and we want to go to beach volleyball. And I love track and field. I like the black and white of sports, you know, that literally come down to a watch. My wife loves the artistic side of sports, the gymnastics and the diving. We will get to that definitely. But I love the here it is, ready, set, go, whoever crosses the line first, because, you know, I'm a swimmer, so I have that peanut brain.
All right, well, Rowdy, keep this in mind. Wednesday, August 17th, women's beach volleyball final. That will likely be a Brazilian team versus Kerry Walsh Jennings and her new partner, April Ross. So talk to your many high-ranking friends at NBC and see if you can secure some tickets for that. That would be the one.
And that's exactly what I'm going to have to do. I'm going to have to try to rob and steal a ticket because they don't give us tickets. You know, I'm trying to get my wife a ticket or two to swimming, believe it or not. So I will definitely try to hit the finals. We were in the finals, by the way, Richard, in 2012, and that was really cool to see beach volleyball final. But I can't even imagine what that's going to be like August 17th.
Yeah, in Brazil, with the chances are very high that a Brazilian team will be there, being the Brazilians are ranked.
Can you imagine, dude? That place will be rocking.
Yeah, it should be great. All right, Rowdy Gaines is the lead swimming analyst for NBC's coverage of the Olympics. He's been doing that since 1992. Gold medalist for this country. We didn't even get into his swimming career, which is remarkable. You know, if we bring Rowdy back, we can get into that. But just go Google him for any of you youngsters. The guy.
Hey, I want to say before we leave, I thanks a lot for having me on, Richard. I've been, and I mean this with all sincerity, I've been a big, huge fan of yours for a long time. I follow you. I read all your articles. And you're doing a great job, so keep up the good work, man.
Our check is in the mail, Rowdy. I'm gonna let my bosses know.
The absolute truth.
I appreciate that. All right, Rowdy, safe travels to Rio, and we will absolutely be watching you on the air. Rowdy Gaines, thank you very much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. All right, back in the studio with Bette Marston. My thanks to Otto Bolton and Rowdy Gaines. And Bette, those were two interesting conversations. The thing I like about both guys is both guys are really prepared. Both are smart. They have a clear passion for their sports. And NBC is in good hands. These are the two, let's be honest, along with gymnastics, the most important sports for them in terms of television ratings and viewership interest. And I think they have the right people in those positions for the Rio Games.
Yeah, they do. Both guys are, former athletes. And honestly, some people knock it when former athletes become analysts. But these guys are both great examples of how they're using the knowledge of their sport, of participating in their sport, to their advantage. And NBC, you know, like you said, Deitch, NBC is very, very lucky to have them. And, Otto was talking a little bit about, you know, how do you handle drugs? You're, you know, talking about drugs on the air, things like that. And I think he always does smart job of it. And Rowdy, I know, been following him for years. I was a swimmer all through, when I was growing up. And so it's always a ton of fun to listen. I have distinct memories of, you know, sitting down in front of the TV and watching all the swim events at the Olympics. And he was always the voice to all that. So, yeah, everything is he does an incredible job. And
yeah, you know, the thing is, like, one thing that was interesting with Rowdy Gaines is he really gives you a sense of just Ledecky's greatness. And you know, we're only a couple weeks away, I think, in the same way we're only a couple weeks away from Simone Biles being a household name. You know, Katie Ledecky by the end of August probably will be a mega, mega American sports star.
Yeah, absolutely. And she won gold back in London. Not a lot of people remember that, in the 800-meter freestyle. And it almost was overlooked. I mean, she was just 15. Right. She, in her demeanor, she's very, very quiet, very calm. You know, she's not, you know, Missy Franklin obviously stole the show in London. Now it's Katie Ledecky's turn. Like, is she going to be the one to rise up and win all the gold?
Yeah, it's interesting just because, like, you know, the you're right. Ledecky's got a different personality than Missy Franklin or Biles, but I'm sure there are people working with her. This is what you got to just sort of like oversell, you know what I mean, during the games when you go on the Today Show and stuff like that, because you know, that can ultimately earn you a ton of money.
Oh, absolutely.
So, you know, it'll be interesting to see if Ledecky tries to get outside herself a little bit and sort of sells it to the American public, because there's so much money to be made after the fact, especially if she decides this is her final Olympics. You have one more thing that you want to add?
Yeah, Ledecky is, she's set to go to Stanford in the fall and swim for the team there. So she won't be turning pro quite yet. I don't know if she has plans to do the Missy Franklin, where she swam for 2 years and then turned professional and then started taking all the different various sponsorships. But for right now, we know that she won't go pro just yet, but I'm sure that
she won't
be able to hold off.
Well, I was going to say, maybe
Speedo
that changes.
Speedo throws several million dollars at her.
If she wins
four
multiple
golds,
medals.
Yeah.
It's crazy. That's the great thing about swimming, though, or like fascinating thing is someone like Missy Franklin can win, be the best in the world, and then goes and competes in Pac-12 meets at Cal, which must be
it's
much fun if you're another.
Great, though.
If you're another swimmer, that must be so awesome. Like you get to swim against the Olympic gold medalist.
Yeah. And Missy loved it. She said she loved being part of a team, and like two of her best years ever were when she was swimming at Cal. And that's something that swimmers a lot of time lose, because swimming is an individual sport. That's why swimmers say they love relays so much. And like, as a former swimmer, it is a blast to be up there and compete with your teammates. Like, you know what, like, when you're at your workouts, you can't even talk to the other person because you're underwater. So swimming ultimately is a very individual, you know, a very individual sport. You're caught in your mind. But that's why swimming with the team, the whole team aspect of, you know, of going to college and even, you know, swimming on relays, that's, swimmers get such a thrill out of it because it's such a change in pace. So I remember even practicing like relay starts. In practice, it's a necessary thing to practice, because if you fall start, you will lose all those points. But even that's fun because you're out of the water and you're jumping around, and it's, you know, you can actually talk to your other to fellow swimmers.
So, you should be jumping on the Aptos
Goldish podcast
on the Olympics when swimming comes around. Yeah, you'd be good.
Yeah, guys. Once again, our plug for the Sports Illustrated podcast feed. It's called Sports Illustrated at the Games. Search it in iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, your podcasting app of choice, and we will have Alex Abnos and Mitch Goldich will be doing a daily podcast about the Rio Games, and then we will also have a couple of other podcasts will be thrown into that feed as well. So subscribe, don't miss anything. And yes, if they invite me to go on the podcast, I will surely accept.
All right, good promos there by Bette Marston. Let's wrap it up. This podcast is getting long.
SI.com/Olympics for all of your coverage from the Rio Olympics.
All right, my thanks to Otto Bold and Rowdy Gaines for being our guests today. My thanks to Bette Marston for producing this, and the other group who helps put all this stuff together, from Alan Kim, John Wertheim, Ryan Hunt, Chris Stone. Am I missing anybody? Dan Bloom, of course, of Panoply. All right, well, I hope you enjoyed this Olympic podcast. We will see you during the game. Some future guests coming up include Andy Roddick, the tennis player turned periscoper, and Arlo White of NBC Sports. He is the voice of the Premier League, so looking forward to those as well. All right, for Bette Marston, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.